You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the Islamic Studies section of the New Books Network, where every few weeks we feature a newer book by an author in the field of Islamic studies. I'm your host, Matthew Long. This week we'll be featuring the work of Muhammad and the Supernatural. This book is by Rebecca Williams and is one of the newest additions to the Routledge Studies in Classic Islam series. Despite the Quranic proclamation that the only miracle which served as proof of Muhammad's prophethood was the Quran, miracles and supernatural events have been ascribed to Muhammad in numerous Islamic literary and intellectual genres. Professor Williams of the University of South Alabama delivers a unique and fresh look at the supernatural in Islam. Specifically, she explores how the Muslim authors Al-Tabari and Ibn Kathir understood and interpreted supernatural phenomena attributed to Muhammad, restricting her analysis to the works of tafsir, or Quranic interpretation, and biography, or sirah, produced by Al-Tabari and Ibn Kathir. She focuses on four life events for Muhammad: his conception, his first occasion of public preaching, a vignette concerning a warning sent by one of his followers, and a failed assassination attempt upon Muhammad's life are prominent because they each feature some sort of supernatural occurrence. These events, in turn, are connected to important themes for Muslims in the medieval era, respectively, sex, politics, betrayal, and wrath. Professor Williams' fascinating comparative investigation of the treatment of these supernatural occurrences by Al-Tabari and Ibn Kathir demonstrates important similarities and differences between these two scholars. Moreover, the reader becomes conscious of the milieu in which each scholar constructed their text. While this is a significant contribution to the field of Islamic studies, the topics addressed are of great benefit to scholars of literature and folklore, and its contents are accessible to a wide spectrum of readers. Hello, welcome to the New Books Network on Islamic Studies. My name is Matthew Long, and today we're going to be talking with Rebecca Williams about her new book, Muhammad and the Supernatural. Rebecca, how are you today?
I'm good, Matt. Thanks. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Well, before we actually get started talking about your work, it would be great if you could tell our listeners a little bit about your biography.
Well, I got my PhD in Islamic studies from McGill University in 2007. And before that, I had gotten my master's degree in history from the University of West Florida in December of 1997. And I had started looking at Islamic studies in general, oddly enough, due to a work of fiction by Louis L'Amour called The Walking Drum. And I was sort of I had an extended illness as an undergraduate, and a friend of mine suggested that I read this book. And Louis L'Amour is famous for his Westerns. And I said, I'm not really into Westerns. And they said, no, this isn't a Western. You've got to read it. And so this book talks about a young man during the medieval period whose father is captured by corsairs. And so he travels across medieval Europe and the Byzantine Empire and the Islamic Near East in search of his father. And I was really struck by how the author really contrasted medieval European civilization with medieval Byzantine and, again, the Islamic Near East. And it was the first experience that I had in reading anything about the Islamic Near East. And I was struck by how L'Amour had portrayed medieval European civilization at the time, and I think this is the 11th century, as being very dogmatically rigid and not a very enlightened place to be. And he contrasted this with Islamic civilization, which was, public baths and libraries and very intellectually stimulating. And so it really just sort of piqued my interest, and I focused my studies on that when I was able to. And then for my MA program, for my thesis, I looked at the historiography, the modern historiography surrounding the life story of the Prophet Muhammad and all of the controversy surrounding that source material, the gap in time between the events described and our earliest written sources, and were the sources, predominantly oral or written, and all of those controversies that were quite prevalent, especially in the, from the 70s through the 90s. And then for my PhD program, I focused, I had sort of gotten into this issue of, okay, are the sources historically accurate or not? Can we use them to determine the historical events? And I, for my doctoral program, when I started working on my PhD under the direction of Don Little, I sort of turned away from that question and decided to evade it altogether rather than attempting to answer it, and instead focused on, all right, well, how did the people who wrote these works perceive these events? And so rather than attempt to look at the life of Muhammad or the life story of Muhammad as, potentially indicative or not of actual historical events, instead I chose to look at how later generations of Muslims perceived that story and how that changed over time. And in looking at the historical accounts, what really struck me were the differences in the miracle stories. And specifically, I focused on At-Tabari, who was a 9th and 10th century scholar in Abbasid Baghdad and very well known for his works of history and tafsir. And just the difference between his work and the work of a much later scholar, Ibn Kathir, who lived and worked in Damascus during the Mamluk period in the 14th century. And there was this huge difference between the number of miracle stories, which is to be expected. There's about 400 years difference between these two men. But the fact that Ibn Kathir pulled these stories from sources that would have been available to At-Tabari, it just sort of got me wondering about, okay, so why did Tabari not include these stories? Why did Ibn Kathir choose to include these particular stories? And then I expanded that to a comparison of, their works in the exegesis of the Quran as well. And that really expanded the picture of how these later generations really viewed the miracle stories of the Prophet Muhammad. And not many people had looked at these particular types of stories very seriously before. And so that made it kind of challenging to put my work into the historiography, which, that's the first part of any doctoral dissertation, is you've got to put your own work into the larger scholarly field. And so I expanded the study and tried to look at it from different ways in order to figure out, okay, how am I going to approach this? And my external reader for my dissertation was Walid Saleh at University of Toronto. And he was just very helpful, gave a lot of good comments that really helped turn the dissertation into a much better work. And that's where I ended up.
Oh, okay. And I mean, it basically from that dissertation then expanded into this larger work that we have here in front of us. And, you know, Al-Tabari and Ibn Kathir, I mean, those are two major authors as well, are they not?
They are. Now, Tabari is admittedly much better known, at least among scholars, than Ibn Kathir. Ibn Kathir is more popular with modern Muslims, predominantly because of his relationship with his teacher Ibn Taymiyyah, who, you know, his works would go on to inform the modern Salafi and Wahhabi movements. And so Ibn Kathir is, you know, he's sort of seen as almost writing Ibn Taymiyyah's coattails, so to speak. But I did have difficulty finding works, especially secondary works, on just Ibn Kathir himself, separate from At-Tabari, at least as separate as could be from At-Tabari, or sorry, from Ibn Taymiyyah. And it's I've been very fortunate in that lately Ibn Kathir is receiving a bit more scholarly attention as, you know, an individual author in his own right. And so that's kind of exciting that these two authors are actually, I mean, whereas At-Tabari had already been very well known, that Ibn Kathir is starting to be taken a little more seriously.
And as you start off in your work, you start to discuss about, you know, the elements of the supernatural, which is actually kind of interesting because that's actually not exactly what the Quran teaches concerning Muhammad's life.
Sure. And that's the real interesting thing that got me started on focusing on the supernatural, that, you know, you've got this Quranic command almost that Muhammad is not going to perform miracles. We constantly have the Quran talking about the unbelievers or those around Muhammad asking him for proof, for some kind of miraculous proof of his role as prophet, and consistently the response is, you know, I'm just a man like yourselves. I'm the messenger of God, but I you know, my miracle is the Quran. And yet, when you get to all of these extra Quranic works, you know, whether it be prophetic biography or you know, the Hadith compilations or Kalam or Tafsir, you have hundreds of different miracle stories in thousands of different reports. And at least as far as Tabari and Ibn Kathir are concerned, they really didn't seem to have a real problem with this apparent contradiction between the Quranic command that Muhammad performed no miracles, and yet the fact that Muhammad is performing miracles left and right in these other extra Quranic genres. And it really, it focused, you know, the reason that I compared these genres between prophetic biography and Quran exegesis was in part because of this. It's like, okay, so if the Quran is saying Muhammad performs no miracles, we've got all of these miracle stories in the Sirah, well, what does the Tafsir have to say? And it's interesting that Tabari and Ibn Kathir approach these two genres in very unique ways, whereas Tabari is very careful at times to differentiate how he portrays a particular event in his Sirah. Tabari portrays this a particular event in his Sirah as opposed to how he portrays it in his Tafsir. And so you see Tabari really working to differentiate these two genres. Ibn Kathir, on the other hand, is more interested in putting forward this program of reform that is admittedly connected to Ibn Taymiyyah, where you have things must rely on the Quran and then on these authoritative hadith. And so Ibn Kathir is far more interested in that program, both in his prophetic biography and in his tafsir, than he is in differentiating these two genres.
And, you know, when you make this, as you're doing the exploration and the comparison, you've really focused on four primary events that, you know, take us through the entirety of your work. And can you kind of tell our readers about those four events?
Sure. So there are, as I said, there are hundreds of miracle stories in both Tabari and Ibn Kathir's works. And I opted, instead of a large overview, I opted to focus on four stories in particular for a variety of reasons, but mainly because these are not particularly pivotal events in the life of Muhammad. So they're not going to be connected with one exception, and I'll get to that in a little bit. They're not really connected to these huge issues. I mean, they are themes that are important to the medieval Muslim community, but, you know, they're not as big as, say, the Battle of Badr or, you know, these much, much larger issues. So I think that you can get a better sense of, you know, if these authors are working to put forward their own interpretation of events on stories that really even aren't all that significant or all that earth-shattering, then, you know, how much more would they be putting their own interpretation of events onto these much larger events? So I opted to look at two events during Muhammad's time in Mecca. The first, and this sort of connects to how I divided things in my dissertation as well. You've got the period of Muhammad's life before he receives the first revelation of the Quran, and then that period in Medina or in Mecca still, from the time he receives that first revelation until his hijra to Medina. And then from the Medinan period, you have the two stories that I chose really work with each other. Again, you have an earlier before Muhammad conquers Mecca, and then in that very brief period between the conquest of Mecca and Muhammad's death. And I think these represent four very important points in Muhammad's life and in the development of him as both a prophet who performs miracles, but also as the leader of this expanding community. So the first one actually is the story of Muhammad's conception, and it revolved around the issue of this light that is seen in Muhammad's father, Abdallah ibn Abdul Muttalib, in his face before he marries Amina, who is Muhammad's mother, and before she conceives Muhammad. Now, At-Tabari and Ibn Kathir, to a certain extent as well, they put the story in the seerah very much in this context of Islam's role, its relationship to the other Abrahamic faiths. And so you have, when Abdullah is on his way to be married to Amina, he's stopped by two women. One is related to a famous Christian, and so the argument is that she is likely Christian herself. And the second woman is a Jewish soothsayer, and both of these women propose sexual relations with Abdullah, and they even offer to give him a number of camels. Typically the number is 100 camels in return. And he rejects both of them. He says, no, 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 I'm with my father, I've got to go. And so then his father takes him and marries him to Amina, and they consummate their marriage. And then he goes back to each of these women and says, well, you know, hey, how about it? And so they both say, no, no. When I made the offer before, there was a light in your eyes, and I wanted that light for myself. And so the light is now gone, so, you know, really I don't have any use for you. And so the theme of this is that, you know, you've got this light of prophecy that is denied to this representative of Judaism and to this representative of Christianity, and instead goes to a woman whose genealogy is supposed to be, you know, the best among the Arabs at that time. And so this whole idea of the relationship between Islam and these Abrahamic faiths, especially in Tabari's version of the story, really points to, you know, the fact that this light of prophecy was intended all along for Amina, and that these other traditions are, you know, they're being sort of left behind. And so this is Tabari's perception of this, the importance of this event. Now, Tabari includes a third story where Abdullah has an additional wife, and where the story takes place at a time other than his wedding to Amina. And again, there are similarities. The third wife, you know, there's this issue of sexual contact, of the light that shone in his face, and for whatever reason he goes to Amina instead, and once they have intercourse and she conceives Muhammad, then the light is no longer there. And so this third woman for Tabari could potentially also represent Arabian paganism. So you've got now not only the two Abrahamic faiths, but Arabian paganism as well being left behind. And so Islam is the fulfillment of everything that came before it. The problem for this, when we get to Ibn Kathir, who does not include the story of this additional wife, is that this would present too many complications. By the time we get to Ibn Kathir, the story of Muhammad's conception has really closed in on itself. Tabari allows for reports that have nothing to do with the supernatural. He, you know, Amina is convinced by her family to marry Abdullah because he's good looking. And so she's like, yeah, okay, sure. And so by the time we get to Ibn Kathir, he does not include any reports that are not connected in some way to the supernatural. So by the time we get to Ibn Kathir, Muhammad's conception had to be connected to a supernatural event, whether it's the attempted seduction by these women, or he also includes the story of a man examining Abdullah's father, Abdulmuttalib, telling him, okay, well, you need to marry somebody from this tribe because then you'll have both rulership and prophecy. And so we see then this connection, him marrying his son Abdullah to a woman of this particular tribe. And so for Ibn Kathir, it has to be connected to a supernatural event. Whereas at Tabari, yes, he has these supernatural events, but, you know, he's willing to admit that, you know, there are other possibilities. And so then when you bring in how they relate this story in the Quran, Ibn Kathir includes a Quran quotation. At-Tabari does not. For the entire time leading up to the first revelation, At-Tabari does not connect any Quran verse to any of the supernatural stories. But he does continue this idea of the role of God and the will of God in deciding where that light of prophecy would go. And so for both Tabari and Ibn Kathir, the importance in their tafsir of the verse connected to this is that, you know, God decides who will be prophet and who will not. And Ibn Kathir chooses to focus on genealogy as this proof of Muhammad's status as prophet. And he even relates this story of this meeting between Muhammad's uncle Abu Sufyan, who at that time was an enemy of his, and the Byzantine emperor Heraclius. And Heraclius has this dream, and he calls for these people to be brought before him, and Abu Sufyan says, yes, okay, there's this guy, you know, this kin and he's claiming to be a prophet. And Heraclius asks these questions. And one of the questions is his lineage good among you? And Abu Sufyan is forced to admit that, yes, it's quite good. And so we have Ibn Kathir, you know, using this idea of Muhammad's lineage as a proof of his prophet and as his prophethood. And this connects to that theme of, you know, divine intervention in who will receive this light of prophecy, who gets to determine who is a prophet and who is not. And so you have all of these interconnected themes between the story in the seerah and their interpretation of the verse of the Quran that is connected to this story. So
very interesting. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
So that story then makes up the first part of your work.
Right.
And so that deals with Muhammad's birth. And then from there, you then move on to the next section where you address a second story.
Right. And so then in the next section, in the second part of the work, I look at a much later event where Muhammad has already received his first revelation, his first revelatory visit from the Archangel Gabriel, and he's been preaching in secret for about 3 years until he receives this Quranic command to openly pronounce the message that God has sent down to him. And so this is where we see the beginning of his public preaching. And this story for both Tabari and Ibn Kathir is separated into two elements. Both present a public announcement by Muhammad where he goes to Mount Hira outside of Mecca and he makes this, you know, he calls everyone to him and he says, you know, I'm a warner. I'm here to warn you of a terrible chastisement. And, you know, his fellow Meccans are like, okay. And so he doesn't get a very good response there. And his another uncle, Abu Lahab, who castigates him for this and says, you know, you called us here for this. And, you know, so he sort of publicly criticizes him. The other story that both Tabari and Ibn Kathir put forward is a private meeting between Muhammad and about 30 or 40 of the male members of his clan. And in this private meeting, this is where we see a supernatural event where he miraculously divides food and drink to feed everyone. So, you know, the story is narrated by Muhammad's cousin and future son-in-law, Ali, who states, you know, Muhammad had me call these men together and he had me prepare food and drink, but there was only enough for one person. And yet Muhammad, after, you know, taking a bite of the meat and after telling them all to eat and drink, you know, there was enough for everyone with plenty left over. And in, you know, in some versions of the story, you can see the traces of their fingers in the food. And in other versions, the food looks as though it has been untouched, even though each man eats and drinks his fill. And the difference, too, in these two very different versions of events, in the public announcement, it's not horribly controversial. But in this private meeting, Muhammad follows up his miraculous division of food and drink with a request. You know, he tells him, you know, I've brought you the best of this world and the next, and he asks for someone to help him, to aid him, to be his brother and his successor or deputy. And of all the men assembled, Ali is the only one who volunteers. And so we have this very politicized incident where Muhammad accepts Ali as his helper and his successor or deputy, and he announces this to the assembled men. And, you know, he says, so obey him as you would me. And the men kind of laugh because Ali is very young and sort of physically unfit at this time. And so they say, they laugh and they say to Ali's father, Abu Talib, you know, he's telling you to obey your son. And they leave. So At-Tabari treats this very differently in between the two genres. Now, in the Sirah, Tabari follows this story up with another report that takes place later during Ali's caliphate. And, you know, someone asks Ali, how did you become commander of the faithful, commander of the believers, and not your paternal uncle, signifying potentially Abbas, who would go on to be claimed as the origin of the later Abbasid dynasty. And so you've got Ali making sure to draw attention from everyone in the room, and then he tells this same story. So the story, the basic story is the same of Muhammad's private meeting with his kin, but it's put into this narrative context of, you know, the ostensibly the rights of the Shia to rule, or the Alids to rule, versus the rights of the Abbasids, and, you know, going back to the progenitors of those two bloodlines. And but At-Tabari, you know, infamously does all of this without comment. He puts these reports in, but he doesn't really give you a lot of guidance as to what his own interpretation of events is. So you're sort of left to yourself to see these different reports. Ibn Kathir, on the other hand, leaves you with no doubt about what his opinion is regarding these events. And Ibn Kathir goes out of his way. First of all, he does not include the second report that At-Tabari includes in his Sirah. But Ibn Kathir, he completely dissects these reports that have Muhammad choosing Ali and naming Ali as his successor. And he attacks their chains of authority. He says, oh, this person was he was recognized as a Shi'i and a liar. He reinterprets the text of the report itself, saying, you know, Muhammad really didn't mean successor. He meant, you know, somebody who would act as executor of his estate if he should be killed in the course of his mission. And then he even brings in a quote from the Quran saying, you know, no, Muhammad was promised by God that he wouldn't die, and that God would fulfill all of these roles that Muhammad had asked of his closest kin, and that Ali was the only one who volunteered for. And so this is how they treat the story in the Sirah, and you see a big difference in this story in particular between how they treat the story in the Sirah and how they treat the story in the Tafsir. And there are a number of different verses that are connected to this story. And, you know, through over 100 separate reports in his Tafsir, At-Tabari only includes one report of a miraculous nature. Only, and it's the one report in his Sirah that does not have that later political contextualization, but that does relate Muhammad's private meeting with his kin, his miraculous division of food and drink, and his asking for help and accepting Ali's help. But that's it. Out of, as I said, over 100 reports, he really minimizes the political element of the story in his Tafsir, and instead focuses on other elements of these verses that have nothing to do with anything controversial at all. And so we see him really differentiating his treatment of something as, you know, controversial as this event in his Sirah, where he gives it a bit more leeway, and in his Tafsir, where he really strictly controls it. And so you get the sense that for At-Tabari, this was not something that was acceptable to him to be discussed at length in his Tafsir. He didn't really see that genre as being useful or appropriate for that kind of discussion. And for Ibn Kathir, however, his really just vitriolic anti-Shia viewpoint is almost identical between the genres of Sira and Tafsir. In fact, he includes the same reports, the same arguments, and his focus is not the differentiation of genre. He is focused more on denying the Shia any potential support for their arguments that Ali should have immediately succeeded Muhammad. And so you really get a sense in this part, especially, of this connection between the two authors, between Tabari and Ibn Kathir, and their own historical milieu. You know, for Tabari, it's, yes, the Shia or the Alid and Abbasid rift is quite real. But for Ibn Kathir, it's very much a Sunni as opposed to a Shia perspective of these events. And that's the argument that he's putting forward. And so that really ends the Meccan period. Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, I was going to follow up real quick. You actually, in your introduction, do discuss some of the background of both Tabari and Ibn Kathir related to their perspectives on the Shia, and sort of kind of address some of their background related to that. So that probably figures into, you know, besides their writings displaying their feelings, but there was also a lot of other background information related to their attitudes towards the Shia in your introductory as well, I believe.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Tabari had been accused of having Shi'i sympathies to the point where at one time he actually had to go defend himself in person to the Caliph Chamberlain and say, no, I'm not a Shia. And so the fact that this was not just viewed as kind of a dry scholarly attempt, but had very real consequences for Tabari in the real world. So you've got this issue. Also, Tabari had written other works that were being used by the Shia of his day to support their own arguments. So this also gets Tabari into a little bit of trouble with the Abbasid rulers. And Ibn Kathir, when we get to his time, I mean, we definitely have a resurgence of the Shia. You know, the Mongols, when they converted to Islam, they started to show favoritism toward Shia Islam as opposed to Sunni Islam. And so we see Ibn Taymiyyah in his own time dealing with this, and Ibn Kathir certainly deals with this as well. And to the point where Ibn Kathir is actually serves on a panel of judges who condemn a man to death in Damascus for going to the Great Mosque and publicly criticizing or insulting the first three caliphs and Muawiyah, oddly enough, the first of the Umayyad caliphs. And so this man is arrested, and Ibn Kathir serves on this panel of judges, and he is one of the men who agrees to put this man to death for these views. And we see with Ibn Kathir, I mean, one of his major concerns is this competition, if you will, between Shia and Sunni Islam.
Interesting. And then as we transition out of the Meccan period into the Medinan period, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that, you know, the overall events involving supernatural seem to escalate. And so are there more occurrences of sort of supernatural events in this period?
Oh, absolutely. And this is one thing. A lot of modern scholars had discounted the reports from the Meccan period because they claimed, you know, there's so many legendary stories of a supernatural nature that, oh, you know, it's obvious that these stories were just being made up. And so instead they point to the Medinan period. Oh, look, you had more people who knew Muhammad in this period, who lived after Muhammad's death to relate these accounts. And yet, if you really sit down and do the numbers, there are exponentially more miracle stories for the 10 years that Madonna or that Muhammad spends in Medina than there is for, you know, his whole life up to the Hijra in Mecca. And it, you know, admittedly, it may be that if you look at the ratio of overall reports for the Medinan period, that perhaps the ratio is the same. But, you know, my sense of it is that, you know, you just kind of have to look at the numbers that you've got just this enormously huge increase in the number of miracle stories for Muhammad's Medinan period. And you really do see a change in the quality of these miracle stories. So when Muhammad, before he receives the first revelation, these miracles happen to him or for him, but you don't really see him acting as an agent in these accounts. Once he receives the first revelation in Mecca, you start to see him exercising a bit of his own control over the supernatural. But when he gets to Medina, it's only in Medina that we see healing stories, where Muhammad is able to heal some of his followers, typically those who have been wounded in battle or, you know, on some errand for Muhammad. And we also see a sharp increase in Muhammad's clairvoyant knowledge of events. And so we see not only the number of miracles, but also the type of miracles really change to reflect Muhammad's increasing, not only his increasing power over an expanding community, but also an increase in how he's portrayed as having power over the supernatural element of his role as prophet.
Mm-hmm. And so then the first story that you address in this Medinan period, you deal with the theme of betrayal in part three of your work.
Right. And in this story, Muhammad is getting ready to go and conquer Mecca. So he's already gone through the battles of Badr and Uhud and the Battle of the Ditch. And he's already had his dealings with the three major Jewish tribes. So he's sort of at the point where he has mastered control over Medina itself. And now it's time for him to expand that and go back and take Mecca and really fulfill that particular part of his role as prophet. But during these preparations, he, you know, Tabari and Ibn Kathir both relate this report from an earlier author, Ibn Ishaq, that says that Muhammad received a warning from heaven that one of his companions had written a letter to the Meccans warning them of Muhammad's impending attack. And so right when you think that Muhammad is, you know, he's on top, he's about to go take Mecca and he's consolidated his control over Medina, we have this act of betrayal by someone who is described by both Tabari and Ibn Kathir as a person who's been with him from the beginning, who made the Hijra from Mecca to Medina, who fought in the Battle of Badr. And the interesting thing about this person, Hatib ibn Abi Bata'a, is that when you look at Ibn Kathir and al-Tabari's account of the Hijra, and when you look at their accounts of the Battle of Badr, you don't see this person's name at all. So we really get a sense that perhaps Hatib is perhaps a literary figure, that he, you know, rather than having this nice long sort of reputation in the story, that this is almost the first time that we hear about him. Now, we get a couple of little blurbs before this particular incident, but really not much. And so, you know, it's almost like this is a contrived event where you have somebody who is ostensibly one of the most important earliest followers of Muhammad betraying him at this pivotal moment. And so Tabari and Ibn Kathir both, they really focus on this issue. Now for Tabari, he really only relates this in one report from Ibn Ishaq. Now, Ibn Kathir relates a few other reports that give variations on this story. But Tabari here, by only relating this one report, is exercising a bit of control over the narrative, because we see that once we get to his tafsir, that there are a number of other reports he could have used, but opted not to. And so it's this, again, this choice that Tabari is making between these two genres. So Hatib writes this letter. He gives it to a woman. She, you know, tucks the letter up in her hair and is on her way to deliver this warning to the Meccans. Now, the reason that Hatib gives for betraying the prophet at this pivotal moment is that he was not actually of the Quraysh, that he was a client. And so that when the other Muslims make the hijra from Mecca to Medina, that they had family members in Mecca who could protect their loved ones and their property that was left behind. But since he was not officially a member of the tribe, he could not count on the same level of protection. He left a wife and children behind. He left property behind. And so, you know, he tells Muhammad, once he's caught and brought before Muhammad, that, you know, I'm still a Muslim. I'm still, you know, believe in you, but I wanted to make sure that the Meccans would protect my family. And here we have this really interesting divergence. You've got Muhammad and Umar, and you've got Hatib, who's brought before him. And Umar is encouraging Muhammad to kill him. He says, nope, he's a hypocrite. He betrayed you. Kill him. And Muhammad says, hold on. How do you know? You know, maybe God looked down on those who fought at Badr and said, you know, do what you will, for I've already forgiven you. And so the story, the narrative element of the story ends there. And so the idea is that Muhammad is definitely leaning towards forgiveness. And yet many of these reports that we have connected to this story then bring up the argument that certain verses of the Quran are revealed regarding this event that contradict Muhammad's desire to forgive Hatib. And instead, they point to the story of Abraham and his followers and how Abraham's followers were correct to tell those closest to them, look, we don't want anything to do with you until you believe in God alone. And in these Quran verses, they say that Abraham was not correct in telling his father, who was not a believer, that he would pray for him, but he, you know, didn't really know how much good it would do. And so when only these four verses of the Quran from Surah 60 are put together with the story, it seems that the Quran is contradicting Muhammad's desire to forgive Hatib. Now, Tabari, in his tafsir of these verses, does include a report that extends the number of verses connected to this event to the first seven verses of Surah 60. And that changes the whole tone of the story, where instead of, you know, seemingly critical of Muhammad's desire to forgive Hatib, it instead supports it, because then you have the followers of Abraham saying, okay, you know, first they're saying, get away from us. We don't want anything to do with you. But then it allows for the possibility of friendship between the believers and the unbelievers, or the possibility that the unbelievers will eventually become believers. And that, you know, again, it goes back to this theme of the power of God. Only God knows. And so only God should be the one to criticize. So the regular believers, and then this connects to Umar's role in the story, you know, they should not take on the role of God in judging their fellow human beings. And Tabari is the only one of the two that includes the story. Ibn Kathir, he portrays his own interpretation of the story very differently. In his tafsir, he includes an introduction where he specifically states, Muhammad received his warning from heaven in response to a prayer that he had said previously, saying, you know, God, we're getting ready to go take Mecca. Please keep all news of this away from the Quraysh's eyes and ears. And Ibn Kathir is the only one to really connect this prayer to the miracle of Muhammad's knowledge about this letter. And Ibn Kathir goes on and says, in his introduction, in this part of his tafsir, that Hatim was a good Muslim, that he supported Muhammad's designs to go take Mecca, but that he was concerned about his family and his property in Mecca. So you see At-Tabari and Ibn Kathir both supporting this idea of forgiveness, but doing it in different ways in the different genres that they're working in. And so you also have sort of the added complexity, at least as far as Tabari is concerned, of chronology. So you have this whole idea that Hatib's letter may not have been originally connected to Muhammad's planned conquest of Mecca, but to the earlier event at Al-Hudaybiyah, where Muhammad goes to go to Mecca, but he's forestalled by the Quraysh at Al-Hudaybiyah. And so you have the issue of chronology. And so you really get a sense that, you know, Tabari and Ibn Kathir in his own way connects Hatib to Hudaybiyah, but via different reports. And so this, you get the sense that both of these men have this received body of reports, and they've got to figure out what to do with them. And you have these contradictory reports. And I think by the time we get to Tabari, the timeline, the perceived timeline of events in Muhammad's life have been pretty much, this is what happened at this point, and then this happened, and then this happened. And so Tabari takes this contradictory report, and he just kind of puts it in there. Without comment, just, okay, here it is. Now, Ibn Kathir is a little more argumentative. He tries to, through that introduction, definitely tries to connect Hatib to the final conquest of Mecca, and not so firmly to that earlier event at Hudaybiyah. But both men do sort of connect him to that. So that shows a sort of uncertainty on both men's parts about the chronological aspect of this particular event. But you also then have this larger theme of forgiveness, and both Tabari and Ibn Kathir, they really portray Muhammad as the forgiving prophet. So when Muhammad does go and take Mecca, you know, there are some individuals that he says, you know, even if they're hiding under the curtains of the Kaaba, they should be killed. But even these people, if they're able to sort of avoid Muhammad's followers who would kill them, if they're able to get to Muhammad himself or to send a representative and ask for forgiveness, in every case, Muhammad forgives them. And it's only those who are not able to get to Muhammad or to send a representative that are eventually killed. And so we definitely see this connection to this theme of Muhammad as the forgiving prophet, even when you've got both Tabari and Ibn Kathir potentially showing that Quran or God is not in favor of that. So you really do get a sense of Muhammad as an independent person there who has his own desires, his own thoughts, and certainly how Tabari and Ibn Kathir portray this, and how they sort of come to grips with it in their own way.
Interesting. So then moving on to the final story of your book, this is actually, when you first hear about it, it's rather interesting because it does have to do with a rather, at least in my interpretation, a rather traumatic event, because it deals with an assassination attempt, correct?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So you've got, after Muhammad conquers Mecca, you have this period known as the Year of Tribal Delegations, where all of these tribes are like, well, all right, Muhammad is the, you know, he's the big guy on the block. Let's go make a deal with Muhammad. And this one tribe, their tribal delegation, they're described right away as troublemakers. They did not come to negotiate with Muhammad. Instead, they came to with plans to kill Muhammad. And so you've got these two men, Amr ibn al-Tufail and Arbad ibn Kays, and they plot to kill Muhammad. And in each of the reports, in both Tabari and Ibn Kathir, you have the men approaching Muhammad. And in some of the reports, you've got Amr attempting to negotiate with Muhammad, saying, okay, well, look, if I convert, what will you give me? And so you have this back and forth with Amr asking for all of these things and Muhammad saying no. And Muhammad basically says, you're going to get what everybody else gets. You know, just because you're a big shot in your own tribe doesn't mean you're better than any of the other believers. And so, of course, Amr is not willing to accept this, and he threatens Muhammad with, you know, raising an army against him. And Muhammad, alternately, depending on the report, either says, God will stop you, or he prays to God for protection against Amr ibn al-Tufail. And so the men go away, and then they decide, okay, let's go back, then we're just going to kill him. And so Amr is supposed to distract Muhammad while Arbad then is supposed to pull his sword and kill Muhammad. And again, depending on the report, you've got different reasons why this assassination attempt fails. Either Arbad claims that Amr was constantly in his way, and then Amr, in Tabari's account, gives poetry. And Amr actually was a famous poet who was oddly enough revered by later generations of Muslims as this great poet. But he says in these verses that, you know, the prophet sent what you saw, basically saying that Muhammad had cast an illusion that made it look as though Amr was constantly in the way, even though he wasn't. In other reports, Arbad claims that his hand became too dry, and so he could not draw his sword out of its scabbard. At times, in some reports, he says that he felt as though he were stuck in a quagmire, and so was unable to draw his sword. In some reports, he starts to draw the sword, and Muhammad sees the reflection of light off of the sword, sees what he's about to do, and leaves, thereby not quite miraculously, but still saving his own life. So you have most of the reports support a supernatural element to the failure of this assassination attempt, where you have a minority of the reports just have Muhammad sort of turning and seeing what's going on. Now, the two men leave, and ostensibly to go and raise this army, and they separate. And so Amr is in, he stops at a woman's house, and he develops this growth in his throat, like a tumor. And very quickly, you know, by the next day or whatever, he's dead of this tumor. Arbad survives long enough to go, in most of the reports, to go back to his own people. He tells them that Amr is dead. He tells them that Muhammad had, you know, invited them to something. And then he basically reiterates his desire to kill Muhammad. And so later he and his camel are struck by lightning. And so you definitely get the sense by both Tabari and Ibn Kathir that these are divine punishments. That whereas in the previous section, Hatib had asked for forgiveness and received forgiveness, in this last section, Amr and Arbad are not asking for forgiveness. They remain very recalcitrant, very adamant in their opposition to Muhammad. And so both of these men are punished quite spectacularly by God and with great finality. They're both dead. and eventually their tribe does become Muslim, and you know, they're incorporated later into the community of believers. But so you've got this theme of divine wrath, and it's really, you know, we see this at the end of Muhammad's life. He's only, you know, he's only got a year or so left to live after this, and we see this concern for the community of believers. So if their assassination attempt had been successful at this very pivotal moment, the community would have been left without a leader. And so you've got Muhammad sort of not only at the pinnacle of his political and military power, but you've also got him at the pinnacle of his supernatural power, in that it's merely his statement, God will stop you, or a prayer to God to stop them, that results in these men's very spectacular deaths. And so you've got then too this connection between, you know, what is it that's going on? Is this supernatural? Is this, you know, merely Muhammad caught a lucky break and these were coincidences? And you've got Tabari and Ibn Kathir both, again, in their own way, across these two genres of Sira and Tafsir, putting forward their own interpretation of events. Ibn Kathir, again, with an introduction in his Tafsir, saying, you know what, this is definitely from God. This is punishment from God. God, you know, through this miracle, saved Muhammad's life, and then through direct divine intervention, killed these two men. Whereas Tabari, in the two genres, he's very certain, again, only one report in the Sira, so again, he's exercising a certain amount of control. In the Tafsir, we see a very different perspective. Tabari in the Sira does not quote a verse from the Quran in relation to this story. But if you look at the verses that are traditionally connected to this story in his exegesis, you see that there are a number of different possible reasons for why these verses were revealed. Either, you know, someone was asked Muhammad about the nature of God, and specifically in a material sense, is God made of, you know, gold or silver or rubies? And this person is then struck by lightning, you know, killed for even suggesting such a thing. And so then you've got the story of Arbad and of Amr. And so the story in Tabari's Tafsir is only one of many possibilities to connect to these verses of the Quran. And so this explains, I mean, this really for me shows that Tabari is trying to be very careful here. So he's not connecting the Quran verse in the Sira to this story, because he's not really sure that this is the story where these verses were revealed. And so it's in his Tafsir, where he's talking about the verses themselves, that he puts forward all of these different possibilities. And for both authors, for Tabari and Ibn Kathir too, we get, especially in their works of Tafsir, this connection to the element of folk magic, and this idea that if you follow the example of Muhammad, that you can, you know, that the average believer can enjoy some of that same divine protection. So you have some reports of what Muhammad would say or do when he heard, when he saw lightning or heard thunder. And in both Tabari and Ibn Kathir, you have this report where Muhammad says, if you say, you know, basically, if you put in this request for God to protect you, if you do what I'm doing, then the lightning won't hit you. You know, the thunderbolt will not get you. And so you have in both authors, and a little more strongly in Ibn Kathir, this element of folk magic, this idea that, you know, not just that, I mean, it's very important for Muslims to follow the normative model of Muhammad, but we also see the introduction of this into the supernatural element as well. If you say the same prayer that Muhammad said, then you will enjoy some of the same supernatural protection that Muhammad enjoyed as prophet of God. And so we see this too, sort of representing Muhammad at the height of not only his political and military power, but also his supernatural power as well.
One thing that struck me as somewhat interesting is the story of Amr and his death in terms of in his throat, and yet he was a poet. So his power came from his speech, and I found that very striking that was, you know, his demise came from where his, you know, this distraction was supposed to come from as well.
That's actually a really good point. I hadn't really made that connection. But yeah, he was important as a poet ostensibly in his own time, but we also have his poetry being collected and recited, well into the Abbasid period. And so I always thought it was sort of odd that you have someone who died because he was trying to kill the prophet being respected for his, you know, pre-Islamic poetry.
Yeah, very highly unusual. Well, that's great. Thank you so much for leading us through those stories that you really highlighted through your work. And, you know, kind of, you know, in terms of wrapping everything up, you know, one thing that I seem to notice is that there seems to be, you know, broadly saying that Tabari seemed to take a very, very neutral position in a lot of times, or maybe not even a position so much as leaving things open most often, whereas Ibn Kathir seemed in a lot of his cases to seem to come to a little bit more of a definitive opinion in some circumstances. What would you say regarding that?
I would definitely agree. I mean, Tabari is sort of frustratingly infamous among modern scholars for not, especially in his seerah, for not really putting forward his own interpretation of events. So you have to kind of dig a little deeper into the structure of how he presents these events to try to sort of suss out what it is he's trying to say. But he's also well known for putting forward these contradictory reports. And I think that really does reflect a certain amount of confidence on his part that, you know, it's okay for me to put these very contradictory reports out there because, you know, the believers are going to come to the right conclusion. You know, it's going to be okay. And yet Ibn Kathir is, his tone throughout both his seerah and his tafsir, he's very defensive. And so, you know, we definitely see Ibn Kathir trying to much more rigidly control, you know, and say, okay, this is the only appropriate interpretation of these events or of these verses of the Quran. And so I think that, you know, either that reflects a defensiveness of Islamic civilization itself, or it could simply be because Ibn Kathir, because he had this connection to Ibn Taymiyyah, you know, there is this huge controversy in Damascus between the leaders of his own Shafi'i madhhab and, you know, his loyalty to the movement of Ibn Taymiyyah. And so this defensiveness could simply be Ibn Kathir's own, you know, reflection more of his own individual struggle in Damascus in this period. And I think that really, I think Tabari gives these alternatives, these choices, whereas Ibn Kathir is very rigidly trying to control the interpretation that his audience comes away with from these accounts. And actually, while I'll be honest, reading Ibn Kathir's accounts, I really didn't like him very much. But because I had such a hard time finding modern studies of him, that's what I've opted for my second project, for the next book project. So Ibn Kathir, there aren't any monograph-length studies of Ibn Kathir. And I think that in his introductions, to his works. And again, for the first book, I focused on his work of history and his work of exegesis. He really is strongly arguing in favor of Ibn Taymiyyah's program of reform, this reliance on the Quran and only on authoritative hadith as found in the six books. And he adds support for Ahmad ibn Hanbal's Musnad as well. But if you dig into the body of these works, you see that he just can't, because too many of those sources don't support his own interpretation of these events. And so for the next book project, I really wanted to expand my study of his entire corpus of works and see if this holds true across the number of different genres that he writes in, if this holds true in his legal decisions, if it holds true in his biographical dictionary, and you know, because I, as I said originally, I really just didn't like him. But then I kind of came to this realization that, you know, for Ibn Kathir, his world is changing, and he's not quite sure how to deal with it. I mean, you've got the fall of the Abbasid dynasty, you've got the coming of the Mongols, you've got the Mamluks. And so this is this really intense period of flux, and not to mention, you know, the rise of Sufism and you know, the rising importance of, you know, quote unquote, popular religious beliefs and practices, and this heightened tension between the Shia and the Sunni. And so for Ibn Kathir, this defensiveness that I had at first interpreted as being quite obnoxious, I now am starting to see as, you know, he's afraid. You know, he's not sure anymore that the community of believers, as he sees them, will make the right decision. And so he's trying to make sure that they interpret these things in what he sees as, you know, the correct way. And so, you know, we'll see how my research sort of plays out when I look at his other works a little more deeply.
Well, we will definitely look forward to hearing about that work sometime on the New Books Network for Islamic Studies in the future, I think, though.
I'll look forward to talking about it.
Okay. Well, I think we've taken up quite a bit of your time today, but, you know, thank you very much for talking with us and sharing, you know, your work with everybody here on the New Books Network.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, and have a good day, Rebecca.
All right. Thanks. You too, Matt.
Thank you for joining us as we spoke with Professor Rebecca Williams about her book, Muhammad and the Supernatural. Please stay tuned to the New Books Network Islamic Studies section for a new interview that will be posted in the upcoming weeks. Also, make sure to check out some of our other channels at the New Books Network. Thank you very much.